From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in 1983 when members of the Rochester community came together to support three-time Olympic paddler Terry Kent of Brighton. Kent, like his fellow Olympians and Paralympians, knew what it takes to chase an Olympic dream. It starts with talent and time, but there's also training and, of course, financial support. A lot that will go into this. And one local Olympic hopeful says the cost of coaching, hotel rooms, plane tickets, competition entry fees, and living expenses can add up to $25,000 a year or more. Well, the Greater Rochester Amateur Athletic Federation, or GRAF, was formed to provide grants to local athletes during their pursuit of Olympic dreams. 100% of GRAF's funding comes from donors, and today we are joined by former Olympians and current Olympic and Paralympic hopefuls. We're going to learn all about this process because even though we're sitting here, well, it's a beautiful sunny day in Rochester, but cold, finally cold in the dead of winter. We're about 7 months away from Rio, and the games are coming, and GRAF is always at work helping athletes in these endeavors. So let me go ahead and welcome our panel. Mike Ingham is here, and Mike's president of GRAF and a former GRAF recipient. Going back to at least, 1992? Is that right, Mike?
Yeah, that's correct. The early 90s, I was pretty involved in training, and GRAF supported me right from the start.
Very good. Well, I look forward to having a conversation about your experience there and then what's going on now. Iris Zimmerman is a member of GRAF's board of directors and a former GRAF recipient in Olympic fencing. When?
I made the 2000 Olympic team with my sister, Felicia.
Wow. What an amazing experience there. All right, Anya Pierce is here, a current GRAF recipient, and training for trials in what, Anya?
In para-kayak, and trials will be end of April in Atlanta at the site of the 96 Olympics.
And before the hour began, I'm asking everybody, where are you from? And Anya says, I'm here in Pittsburgh and Fairport, Germany. But Germany by way now of, where is home for you now?
Pittsburgh.
In Pittsburgh now. Well, we look forward to having a conversation about your Olympic dreams there. Emily Wright is a current GRAF recipient in training for Olympic trials in kayaking.
Yes.
All right, very good. Thanks for being here. And on the line with us is Miranda Melville, a current GRAF recipient and training for Olympic trials in race walking, Miranda. How are you?
Good, thank you. How are you?
Good. You've got to tell us, for everybody listening who isn't familiar with the sport of race walking, what it is.
It's just a form of walking that has two technical rules where one foot has to be on the ground at all times, and your lead leg, when it hits the ground, your knee has to be straight until it is past the body where you can then bend to bring it back through.
All right. Well, I really had no knowledge of this, and I'm so excited to learn more about this. Miranda, thank you for being here. I kind of want to start the hour with Mike and Iris to help us understand really what the mission is and how broad the mission is, because, when the Olympic Games come, what tends to happen is I think the ratings are always so high for the Olympics because people love watching the competitions, but people also love connecting with the personal stories. And so many great personal stories are about overcoming hardships and things like that. But even at those Olympic moments, you're seeing the end of the story, or at least the end of the culmination of getting to the Olympics. You're not seeing the weeks and months of training, the financial support that's necessary, the work that goes into it. And so, Mike, why don't you tell me a little bit more about GRAF's sort of scope, about actually trying to place Olympic athletes?
So GRAF's mission is pretty simple. It's to support Rochester area local Olympic hopefuls and athletes. So we're not looking to support athletes that aren't Olympic hopefuls. And we raise money to do that through generous contributions, and then also we try to sometimes find in-kind things that might help the athletes as well.
How many athletes do you think you can place this year?
Well, we have 7 current recipients, and we're hoping, if we can get a third of those to the Olympics, that would probably be pretty good.
I mean, we're sitting here with people either who've been in that category or could be in that category. But again, you say you don't fund this, you don't get involved unless you really think there's sort of a realistic hope. How do you determine that?
It's not so much the hope, it's a realistic effort. So we fund pretty much anybody who's ever asked that's truly trying to make the Olympics. Now, we may fund them a little differently depending on their need and their chances. But in general, if they're making a legitimate effort, we're going to support them in one way or the other.
I know, but I'm a 9 handicap. I can't come to you and say, I want to play in Rio.
No, you can't if you don't have a legitimate chance. But, in the end, especially early in the quad, who are we to decide who can mm-hmm. and can't? I think that's sort of short-sighted of us. Now, we may say, hey, listen, we're going to help you out a little bit here, but, you know, let's see you put in a real effort, and you know, maybe we can try to motivate them and see if they're the real deal or not themselves.
All right. Well, Iris, when it comes to then the expenses and the support necessary, again, we know that when you're finally going to Rio or wherever you end up going, your Olympics in 2000 was where?
In Sydney, Australia.
In Sydney. So when you go to Sydney, I mean, everybody is aware of the support it takes to put a team and put athletes there. But what realistically is the kind of support necessary for athletes who are training and have these dreams?
So I think that most people look at the swimmers or the gymnasts who have these sponsorships. A majority of the athletes that go to the Olympics don't have those types of sponsorships. So when I was fencing, you train for those Olympics for 8 years out. So each year you're trying to fundraise somewhere between, and that's a realistic number, $25,000 to $30,000. We travel all over the world. The training expenses, the coaching expenses, and you're traveling with yourself and a coach and the team. Even if you're one of the top athletes, your national governing body, like U.S. Fencing, will give you some money, but it's very little. So when I joined GRAF because I would receive a check in the mail from GRAF after I received a grant, and it would literally go into the bank, and I would get on the plane, and it would literally go to the hotel costs of, you know, wherever I was. And Emily's shaking her head, exactly. You know, it was very important. GRAF played a very important role for me.
When we see the shots of the athletes, you know, I'm picturing, you know, in Winter Games and all the athletes coming into the stadium, and you see an entire nation, and in this country especially, we do tend to focus on kind of the big high wattage stars or the big high wattage sports that are sponsored in that way. Maybe I've got the wrong idea. I kind of always thought, well, you know, maybe Gabby in gymnastics or maybe others in skating, they are big stars. They're sponsored. But at least those sponsorships can, again, spread out. And there may be 100 athletes, and the one or two or three or five big stars get the sponsorships. But doesn't that lift all the boats? And it doesn't sound like that's necessarily the case.
Not at all. Not at all. And the athletes that are sitting around the table have all had to do that. Not only are we sending information to GRAF, but we're trying to find other ways to fundraise for ourselves. It's not an easy task because Anya was even saying that she works a part-time job. And one thing you don't consider that we have to quit our jobs for 2 years out for the Olympic Games so that we're training full-time. It's a full-time position. The Olympic Committee used to have this O-job program where you could work at Home Depot at the same time. Work, I put in quotes because it's like you don't really show up that often. And then they would kind of give you some money. But they don't have that anymore. So money is becoming less and less. And in order to even receive some of those grants from the national governing body, you have to be really, really good at that top. But how do you get there? You know, 4 years, 8 years out, how do you even get there? So I think people don't realize how much of a full-time job it is. And on top of that, you have to stay on top of trying to fundraise. And a lot of these athletes, you'll see, they'll have Facebook pages, they'll have these GoFundMe pages, they'll have these Twitter pages. And it's a lot of work. And it's not just being an athlete. It's being an athlete and also your own marketing guru.
Well, I want to kind of work through the individual stories then, if we could, with our panelists. Four in the studio, one on the phone, because every individual story I think is so interesting that is on the road to what they hope will be to the Olympics. And when you look at what GRAF has done and with your own alumni, I didn't even know until I saw the list. Stacy Penjin's on the list, my former colleague over at 13WAM. Now she is a meteorologist at WROC. I know she was a fabulous skater. I didn't know she was GRAF supported. She sent me a note this morning saying, yeah, GRAF was so helpful in her work there. And she didn't have the success. I mean, she's very successful. She didn't have the success in the Olympics of someone like Megan Musnicki, for example, who is a past and former. Is that right?
She's now, she's also one of our grant recipients in the last grant cycle.
Okay, so and that's an Olympic gold medalist down from Naples. So you do have some interesting names. Kathy Turner in the past, that's just another. I think that goes back to around, I think she was skating in 90,
yeah,
mid-90s, right?
Yeah, she was early mid-90s, and yep.
Back in Mike's days. So let's go back, let's kind of work backwards a little. And so Mike Ingham, who's the president of GRAF and a former GRAF recipient, again, your sailing days were back in, started when, Mike?
Well, I mean, as far as the Olympic level, I did college before college and mm-hmm. college, but, you know, not that long after I got more and more involved, and it started with local and regional and national successes that kind of led to the U.S. sailing team, which is the governing body, which is the feeding for the Olympics. So that's how it all kind of came about.
What kind of role did Graf play?
They just like everybody else said, it's, you know, that check came in the mail right as you were trying to board a plane and you're out of money. You're trying to work part-time jobs. You were, and the closer it got to the games, the less time you had for that. So then you still have to support yourself. So it's not like just by not working you lose the income to go pay for your training, but you also lose it to pay for your food and your life.
And how did the sailing career turn out for you?
Well, it turned into you know, a full-time job now, and so now it's more about coaching for the Olympics and the Paralympics as well.
And how is that going now?
So far it's so good. I'm in the middle of coaching the Paralympic team, the sailing team, and end up narrowing it down over the last year. I was helping out with the able body as well, and then you end up going with the guys that have the biggest drive and the best potential. So I really teamed up with one team now that's halfway through their trials. We just got back from Australia where they qualified the country. So first they have to qualify for the country to even go. So there's not a guarantee that anybody goes. But even within the country, once you qualify the country, only one team goes from each country. So it's highly selective. I guess I picked the right guys. They have a pretty good lead in that first half of their trials now. So a really good chance that we'll be finishing up the next 7-8 months, getting ready for Rio and be there.
How many, we'll never know the answer to this, but there have to be a good amount of athletes, Olympic and Paralympic, around the world, but even in this country, who could be good enough and just don't have the support.
Sure. I mean, there's getting the support, it's a big chicken and egg, right? You're going to get some support eventually if you work hard enough at it and you get some legitimacy, both in fundraising and for getting your governing body to help you. So it's hard to get money if you're not legitimate. Like you asked before, how do you decide to give money to? And that's one of the reasons we give something to just about everybody that's trying. But eventually, once you get to the point where you're good enough, you get a little bit of funding, but not much other support.
Iris, for you, 2000, fencing in Sydney. But what was your road? Tell us what that was like.
I received a scholarship to fence at Stanford. I did that, won the NCAAs, and then I tried out for two Olympic teams. I was an alternate to 2004, and then in 2008 I was too injured to continue. So I stuck around, and my sister and I purchased the Rochester Fencing Club, and where we grew up and where we started. And we have recently, in November, moved the fencing club to Henrietta, to a larger facility. And it's become a passion, and partly Graf. Graf is giving back to the community, and I take that, and my fencing club also does that. So I take what Graf gave me and what people did for me and supported me, and I'm trying to make the fencing club into a place that gives back to the community. And so I think when people give to Graf and when we give to the athletes, they come back and they help others. So I think it's an important part of the community, and I say that it is part of the path. Everyone who helped me along the way are part of that path. And so I've come back to Rochester, and many of these athletes are back in Rochester, Kathy Turner, Stacey Pengen. So Graf itself plays an important role, and the athletes that are pushing themselves become leaders in this community.
I'm thinking of just that difference then from what we see in Olympic coverage to the decisions that most Olympic athletes or Olympic hopefuls have to make. Because most are not Michael Phelps, who are mega supported. That's the job, to wake up and eat 12,000 calories and then swim like crazy. You know, that's it. That's all you really have to worry about. It does sound like a lot of Olympic hopefuls have to decide, especially when you get through the end of a cycle, and say, am I going to do this again? You know, am I going to spend 4 years preparing when I don't know where income's coming from, and what's my career going to be after this? I mean, that's a lot of consideration and pressure on potentially world-class athletes, right?
It's a lot of pressure because you don't know. I mean, in the end, what am I going to do? I know how to fence. What am I going to do? You know? But you know what? At the root of everything is, why do we do anything? We're very passionate about it. We found something we're very passionate about. And like I said, eventually we take what we have and we give back. And yes, we're not Michael Phelps. Not all of us are. We're not going to be. We're not going to. I certainly can't eat 12,000 calories. But
that's what I was reading. Stacks and stacks of chocolate chip pancakes. In fencing, you don't get that luxury.
Right. And so actually, no, a lot more fencing. I'm going to an Olympic alumni gathering in Vegas in the end of or the middle of February, and most of the athletes that you see on that list you won't recognize because NBC won't cover us. But we're all out there, and these are the type of people that push themselves. These are the type of people that I want my two children to know. You know, I want my children to know Emily, to know what she does and what she's passionate about. Just because we don't receive sponsorship doesn't mean that we're not legitimately doing it, that we're not giving it all we can every day when we get up and get on that water, get on the fencing strip. And that's what I want my children to learn.
All right, well, then let's get to know Emily ourselves as well. Emily Wright is a current GRAF recipient training for the Olympic trials in kayaking.
Yes.
Tell us about a little bit about your background. Again, where are you from and how you come to this point?
Well, I'm from Fairport, and my dad always loved kayaking, so I sort of loved kayaking as a kid too. When I was 14, I kayaked across Lake Ontario, which was a big trip, set some world records, got a ton of press coverage here in town, and so some of the local racers kind of picked me up and said, you know, you're gonna try this now. So I tried racing and I loved it, and I had a pretty good amount of success at it as a teenager. And after high school, I moved out to the Olympic Training Center in San Diego. And I raced internationally for a couple years, made it to 4 world championships, world cups, and just as Iris was saying, resonated so well with me. I did not make the 2008 Olympic team. I came in 5th at U.S. trials. And
and how many top three? I'm assuming three. How many are going? Two?
One.
One?
They sent
okay.
one.
Oh, one.
And that's based on like what Mike's saying was earlier. You have to be internationally ranked in order to get a spot. They could send none. And that year they sent one. So after, you know, 2010, I decided that, I wasn't getting any younger. It's time to go to school, time to find a career, time to do all these things. So I moved back here to Rochester. I live in Victor now. And this summer I actually met Anya. And Anya has inspired me to get back to racing and try out for the Olympics this year. So we have this awesome summer of training behind us, and Anya won world championships, and now we're both racing at kayak trials at the end of April, Anya in the para events and me in the able-bodied events at the 96 Olympic venue in outside of Atlanta.
All right, so that'll be outside of Atlanta end of April.
Mm-hmm.
And what's the you know, what's the likely result this year? I mean, they're going to take how many, et cetera?
Well, it's kind of complicated, but they're going to send the girl who wins most likely in each race will get to go to the Pan American Championships, which are 2 weeks later actually at the same venue. And the Pan American Championships is all the countries from Canada, Mexico, entire South America, and the one winner of Pan Ams will go to the Olympics. So you win U.S. trials, you get to go to Pan Ams and fight for that spot against 20 other countries. One goes. And each of those countries has sent their best girl to that race. So it's, extremely cutthroat.
So, Emily, they told me you're really good, but just math makes me nervous for you.
Yeah.
How do you feel?
Well, I mean, I feel like I'm going to go in it with my fists up, and the first step is to win U.S. trials. So that is what I'm focusing on now, and then we'll focus on the next step after that.
How was your summer of training?
It was wonderful. Anya and I were training out on the canal in Pittsburgh.
My son and I probably saw you many times.
We probably
just
did. We launched right behind the library there on that.
I told him don't skip rocks at people when there's people flying by.
Yeah. So the training went wonderfully this summer. So.
And how? How realistically, good do you feel about your chances?
I feel good about my chances.
You can win in the end of April.
Yes.
That's awesome. And tell me a little bit about how GRAF has helped you.
Well, GRAF first supported me in 2005 when I was 17, and I had made my second and third World Championships team that summer. And, yes, the check came right as I was ready to go. But
you were smiling.
Then,
Iris is telling the story. Mike's telling the story, and you're going, yes.
Yes, that's exactly how it worked. But when you're 17, my wonderful, wonderful parents were my main contributors. So now I'm just turned 28 and, you know, can't ask mom and dad for money anymore. And we're not independently wealthy. So the fundraising has been huge. The graft support has been very helpful and a big part of why I've been able to keep going.
Can I go back to when you were 14 and went across Lake Ontario?
Yes.
14. Did you have people sort of like Diana Nyadding around you? You know, like, you know, I know there's no stingrays out in the middle of Lake Ontario, but still, did you have people kind of helping, surrounding you at
yes,
all?
Yes. So it was me and two other women, and we went, we launched from Sodus Bay, and we went 52 miles straight north up to Canada, and we had a sailboat there in case of disaster. A couple people on the sailboat sort of charting our course, and we never got out of our boats, though, so that was our...
How long did it take you?
13 hours.
You were 14 years ago, so you were 14 years old.
Yeah, 14 years
ago. You remember how you felt when you started off?
Yes, I couldn't lift my arm to brush my teeth that night, and...
You mean when you were done?
When I stood up on the other side in Canada.
Couldn't lift your arm.
Could not lift my arm to brush my teeth. And so when these guys in Rochester approach me and say, hey, we want to recruit you for the sprint kayak team for a 500-meter race that's going to take about 2 minutes, I'm like, yes, sign me up. I'll do it. I never, never want to be in a boat for 13 hours again.
Were there any scary moments?
Yes, actually, there was a scary moment when we realized that we were out of sight of land. And I've never had that experience before.
Kind of felt disconnected, detached.
Totally. I'm 14 years old, and I'm out there in the middle of the lake, and I can't see any land anywhere. And then we did have a little bit of a scare with some storm clouds coming up behind us, and our sailboat navigators told us we needed to pick up the pace. So that was nothing crazy. But, you know, as a teenager now, looking back on it, it's pretty crazy to think about doing that.
It's an amazing story, and it would be the perfect little bookend to some Olympic dreams.
Yes.
And that would be really, really special. So, you know, here's hoping. And you've been training with Anya Pierce, a current graft recipient, training for the Olympic trials in para-kayaking, and won gold in August in the World Para-Canoe Competition. So you're already sort of kind of rocking it, Anya. It sounds like you're doing wonderfully.
Well, that was a wonderful moment because it gave me the complete set of medals I had when I started out previously, World Championships. I got in silver, then I got in bronze, then I got in fourth place, and I wasn't sure where I was going to land this year. And to get gold was a wonderful reward for all the time that Emily and I had put in on the canal. And Emily was, I think, a big part of my ability to push myself really hard during training. There's no, nothing like having a really strong training partner.
And what is the next step then for you? Emily again said end of April for her. That's what she's kind
same
of going
for me.
Same for you. Yep.
Yep. We'll be in Atlanta together. And the wonderful thing about our sport is that able-bodied and disabled-bodied compete side by side at U.S. Nationals, also at World Championship level. We're not segregated anymore. That was something from the past. And it's wonderful that we get to, all about inclusion, about cooperation, about helping each other out.
How did you come to the sport to begin with?
Kind of a long story. I was a gymnast as a kid and then was diagnosed with cancer. And before I knew it, I was hopping around on one leg.
Got diagnosed with cancer at what age?
At 10.
At 10?
Age 10. And I thought that's the end of sport, not knowing that there is, or was, still is, a lot of sport for disabled people out there. And I, after I recovered, I started adaptive volleyball. I was also fairly successful in skiing, three-track skiing, which made it to the German national team. But like everyone else, I got to a pretty high level. There was very little support. And at some point when I didn't make top athlete, I was faced with a choice. You go back to school and excel, get a career, and make a living, or what are the options? So after I graduated from high school in 88, I put a stop to all sports and I immigrated to the States, came here for college and had a family. I have two kids, and sport became past the recreational level became very, I mean, I didn't know that there was something out there. And I think it was 3-4 years ago, I was co-teaching at Nazareth College a course in amputee fitness, and I met the local paracanoe coach, and things started from there.
Had you been sort of out of any sort of competitive athletics for
Absolutely.
A long time at that point?
Absolutely, since 88.
Since
I really 88. Haven't competed in
wow.
any sport. I mean, like I said, I stay active. I ski at Bristol. I, you know, I go out on the lake in my kayak, recreational kayak, but I really, no competition.
So what's really interesting for me is, you know, so you have cancer at 10, which is, you know, obviously unusual and sad enough to begin with. You lost a leg.
Mm-hmm.
You said you lost a leg. But you became an athlete in so many different sports, it sounds like. You know, you must be a tremendous athlete to begin with. And for you to have to kind of choose one now to focus on, because 3-4 years ago, you're having this conversation. What led you back to a boat, for example?
Well, one of the things was my kids are older now. They're teenagers. One is out of the house. And in college, there was time and a little bit of money, flexibility financially, to dedicate myself to a sport again. And I think I'm somewhat competitive by nature, so it was really appealing to me to find an outlet for that competitiveness. I see all my friends who become triathletes or compete in one way or another, and I've never had that. So to fall into the Paralympic movement at this time of my life has been a wonderful opportunity.
Emily, is she just ripped on a boat? I mean, like, she seems like this amazing athlete. She's just...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. When I met Anya in April, I had no idea she lived in Pittsburgh, which is so crazy. And she was... We went out paddling together, and she told me that she has done really well at World Championships in canoe. And they've just taken canoe out of the Olympics for para. And so she needs to do kayaking or else no Olympics, right? And so she's telling me, oh, I'm going to go to U.S. Trials this year, and I'm just going to do my best, and whatever happens, happens. And it'll just be fun, you know, because I'm just getting into the kayak and just sort of learning about it because it's a totally different boat, totally different stroke. And I'm like, Anya, you got to go for it. You know, and I'll help you get there as best I can. So she, you know, we trained together for, when was your trials?
In July, right?
In July.
In
so
Lake Lanier.
We trained together from April to July. She goes there, crushes trials, wins in a kayak. And she's only been kayaking for
That's amazing.
Like it, 6 months. She'd been canoeing before that.
That's true. So I was very successful in canoeing, and my 3 medals are in para canoe. And I was all excited to represent para canoe, and then I was told, oh, sorry, we took that out of the Paralympics. We can only allow the kayakers to go. That was a big disappointment for me. And then, like Emily said, I said, what do I have to lose? Let me order a boat. So 9 months later, my boat comes from Portugal. I sit in it. Feels very wobbly. It sounds like, okay, it's a boat either way, but it's a totally different sport.
Sure.
You use some of the same muscles, but I had no technique. So Emily was a big part of why I was so successful last year in para kayak right off the bat.
What a story.
And she's a huge part of why I'm here today going forward again.
So the first times we went out, she had two...
So when we kayak sometimes to make a workout harder, we put what we call a resistance band around the boat. So basically it's a string with 3 tennis balls, and there's holes in the tennis balls. The string's strung through the tennis balls. Okay, and so you can put 3 tennis... So you put that on your kayak around, so you can picture your kayak, and you slide this loop of a string with tennis balls around it around your kayak. So now it's right behind your seat. It's going around. And you can put 3 tennis balls down on that loop, or you can slide one up, and now there's only 2 that are under the water. You can slide 2 up, and now there's only 1 under the water. Can you picture that?
Mm-hmm.
Right. So I started out paddling with Anya with 3 tennis balls. And we paddled for a few weeks, and then like all of a sudden I'm working really, really, really hard, and she's starting to beat me. So I go, okay, slide one up, two tennis balls, and then we
did that
for a
few
weeks.
And that was the greatest reward for me.
And
okay, when
like,
is the next tennis ball
she's
coming
like,
up?
Oh,
when
you is- only got two right now, and I'm like, yeah, because I can't keep up anymore. And so then, one tennis ball, and so, yeah. So you can see her progression in speed for the summer. She's improved so quickly.
And Anya, forgive my ignorance and only take this question as a compliment to you, but are you older than most of the people you've competed against?
Actually, on the para side, we do have a contingent of people my age,
okay.
Meaning over 30. and then, funny enough, then there is the next group of are more like Emily and younger, more student age, I would say between 18 and 20, but specifically in kayak and canoe, mm-hmm. in my sport, we have a set of people the 40s.
Well, Emily is only 28, and yours sounds like you were kind of crushing her this summer. So what an amazing story. And so if you're just joining us this hour, we're meeting Olympic hopefuls from our area, and we're understanding what GRAF is. And before I get to our break, I want to bring in the fifth person on the panel who's on the phone with us, and that's Miranda Melville, who is a current GRAF recipient training for the Olympic trials in race walking, training in San Diego now. She's a Rush Henrietta grad, and Miranda, I'm reading that you set a new American record in winning the women's USATF 5K National Race Walk Championship on December 27th. Is that right?
Yes, I did.
At RIT?
Yes.
And let's go back to the beginning of your story, because when we talk about race walking again, for our audience just joining us, they're going to be less familiar with that than they would even be with kayaking and fencing, I think. So what is your own story? You know, Rush Henrietta grad, but athletically, tell me about your story.
So I was in high school, and I was just looking for something to stay in shape for lacrosse in the spring, my freshman year of high school. And so I joined indoor track and field, and they needed points, you know, for every event, and so they had me try race walking. And race walking just happens to be, for girls, very popular in New York State. It's the only state that really offers it, and they offer it at the distance of 1,500 meters, so just under a mile. And so, you know, I did it the first time, and I felt so ridiculous doing it, and I was like, I'm never going to do this again. And then, lo and behold, the next meet, I was in that event again. And so it really kind of just kept growing on me, and as I just became more and more competitive and wanted to get better. And then my senior year, or right before my senior year of high school, I went to a race walking clinic in Boston where they said, you know, you should really think about pursuing this. You have a lot more potential. And so I kind of rearranged in my mind of at that time where I was going to apply to colleges. I looked more at colleges that had a race walking coach. I ended up going to the University of Wisconsin Parkside, where there was a very well-known and very strong coach there at the time. And I did my 4 years there under him. And then I graduated in 2011, knowing the next year was an Olympic year, and I wanted to give it my all in an Olympic year. And I moved out to San Diego to be a full-time athlete right after I finished college.
And you're competing, Miranda, at what distance in race walking?
It's 20 kilometers, so 12.4 miles.
Wow. Whoa. The distances, are they all generally pretty different with race walking than we would see in a sprint, you know, running those kind of events, or are there some similarities?
I mean, it's very similar in that, you know, it is a distance event, so you have to make sure you're putting the mileage in. You need to do different speed workouts. You need to put in your long days, your easy days, make sure your recovery, doing the strength training. But it's a whole different fluidity in your body. Mm-hmm. It's one of the most technical sports of track and field, so you really have to pay attention to your technique.
Yeah, so tell me a little bit about the technique. I mean, we're all envisioning it, but tell me about the rules of what it means, and then tell me a little bit about what makes someone have a good technique for race walking.
So the rules again are 1 foot has to be on the ground at all times according to the human eye or the human naked eye. So, you know, you can't go up and take a picture and then go up to a judge later and say, hey, look, they were off the ground. Well, it doesn't count. They didn't see it in the race. So you can't disqualify them for that reason. So there are judges all over the course. There's usually 3 to 6 judges. and they're rotating at all times so they can see you on different parts of the course, on the turns, and see what you look like, make sure you're staying legal. And then the other big rule is that you have to have your knee straight when your foot hits the ground, and then it can bend to come back through. And so anybody who, you know, has like a very hoppy technique or like their shoulders tend to come up really high, it can give the illusion that you're not doing it properly, and that can ultimately disqualify you. You can get what is called 3 red cards in a race, and if you get 3 red cards from 3 separate judges, you are disqualified. So you can be disqualified in the first kilometer, or you could be disqualified after you finish the race. So it can be a very, like, you have to be paying attention at all times.
What if you get a card once or twice? Is it a time penalty?
No, there is no time penalty. If you get 2 and you make it through the race, then it's okay. Like, you made it through somehow. 2 of the 6 judges thought you didn't look good, and then 4 of the 6 thought you looked fine.
Does that happen, Miranda?
Oh, sorry, go ahead.
Does that happen?
Yep. There is Olympic champions, Pan Am Game champions that have 2 red cards and win medals all the time.
Wow.
It all just depends on if you can get by and coast through to the end.
Well, you just set the American record in 5K. What's a record time in 5K?
Time that I did was 22 minutes and 39 seconds for the indoor 5K. For my outdoor time, my best time is 21:41. And so, I mean, it also depends on the time of year when you race. Like, this was very early in my season. We had just are finishing up our base season where we have lots of high mileage. We're doing about close to 90 miles a week with also 3 times a week of big strength training. And so there's not much speed work there yet. And then we're now going into our early racing season where it's going to be mostly indoor races until spring, where it'll be outdoor stuff.
All right. And then forgive me, Miranda, if I missed it, but let our listeners know, as someone who is a current graft recipient and training for the Olympic trials in race walking, what is the timeline and, you know, what do you need to do next?
So our trials are June 30th in Salem, Oregon. We're the first track and field event to compete in a week-long event that will be going on up in Oregon for all track and field events. And the way it works for track and field is that they take the top 3 with the Olympic standard that day at the trials. So you have to be having the standard or get the standard on that day, and you have to come in top 3 at trials.
I'm going to ask you what you think your chances are.
Right now, they're very good. I'm only 1 of 2 women right now in the U.S. who have the standard. And so if they take top 3, then right now it's a guarantee that I'll go. I just have to go and race that day.
And stay healthy, I assume.
Yes, and stay very healthy, yes.
So tell me about where Graf comes in supporting you.
So Graf has been supporting me since late 2011, early 2012. In 2012, you know, I went to Europe for my first big kind of international races, and just like Iris and Emily have said, that, you know, that check comes just right in time, because, you know, you leave, you're getting on the plane, you're checking in your bags, and, you know, you get that check, and you're like, it's a relief being like, okay, everything's going to be fine, you're going on this trip, everything's going to work out well. And then I had a strong 2012 year. And, you know, they have just been so supportive every year up until this year as well. They have made it so that I can keep training and keep pursuing. And, you know, like they said, it's not just weeks and months and days, it's years. It's years of, you know, lots of patience and lots of hard work, and they're making it capable so that I can put in this work and make everybody proud.
It sounds like that's not an overstatement, Miranda. You know, I mean, I was talking to someone just a couple of hours ago before the program began, someone who's very plugged into this community, someone who probably watches a lot of Olympics, and he'd never heard of Graf and wasn't aware of, you know, I asked, well, how many Olympic athletes do you think we have in this area? I said, yeah, I don't know, 1, you know, 2. And the answer is, you know, maybe 6 or 7 being supported right now. And we could see some, you know, more success from local athletes than I think people even realize locally. But it does sound like it's not overstating it, that without Graf, maybe some athletes like you, Miranda, would legitimately decide that it's not something that is feasible. Is that fair?
No, that is completely fair. And it's just like everybody else was just saying earlier, that you don't have the support financially from all these big named companies. You know, you try to rally up and get the most that you can out of any type of support, but really it's Graf that's behind you 100% all the time, every month, every day, and they want to hear of your success. You know, they support you no matter what, whether it's a good or bad race. You know, they want to see you succeed and keep working hard, because many of these board members have done it already, and they know what it's like, and they really can empathize and relate, and so they know the struggle and how much it takes to keep pushing through, and they are so, you know, loving and kind that they want to be able to help you through this time and make you successful.
Well, an email from a listener named Jack says, wish the athletes good luck, very interesting, and if you could just ask them, I'm always curious to know why they want to be in the Olympics. Let's get a short break in, and we're going to come back, and we'll ask Miranda Melville, Emily Wright, Anya Pierce that question. We'll talk to Iris and Mike about their past experiences and their thoughts on why you do it. We've been talking a little bit about that, but Jack, we'll ask your question when we come back as we talk about going to the Olympics and what GRAF is, the Greater Rochester Amateur Athletic Federation, and who they rely on for help. That's all coming up next on Connections. And Wednesday on Connections, you might have seen Governor Andrew Cuomo with his executive order on helping the homeless during cold weather times. You know, some folks think that might not really be doable for local law enforcement. Can you force someone into a shelter when it's under 32 degrees? We'll talk to people in the local homeless community about the governor's order, who it's intended to help, and whether it will help. That and more tomorrow on Connections.
Hello, my name's Walton Goggins. Nice to meet you. I'm from Lithia Springs, Georgia.
That is what the actor Walton Goggins sounded like when he got to Los Angeles as a 19-year-old hoping to become an actor. Then he got some tough advice in acting class.
The first thing he handed me was a book of sonnets by Shakespeare, and he said, you need to lose that accent.
The star of Justified and the new movie The Hateful Eight, later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
This afternoon at 4 on WXXI.
Welcome back to Connections. Every 2 years, we get to watch Olympics in some form, winter and summer. This year, in August, the summer games will be in Rio. And, you know, as we said earlier in the hour, we get to know a lot of the athletes, certainly not by any means a majority. We get to know the big stars, and then sometimes we get to know some really compelling personal stories. But this hour, we're getting to meet many of the local athletes who have dreams of doing that kind of thing, but might not be able to do it without some support of an organization like GRAF. And we're talking about just what it takes to become an Olympic athlete, from the training and the work and the money and the travel, and hearing some really remarkable stories. And one of our listeners named Jack just wants to know why you do it. So Miranda, you know, you don't have to be doing this. You could have decided to do something else, especially when you think about the fact that as you're getting on a plane, you're just hoping and praying that check came in just to make sure that the bills are paid. I mean, that's stress you didn't need to do. You could be doing something else. Why are you doing this, Miranda?
I'm really just doing it because I love it. I mean, you know, it sounds weird to say, like, oh, I love race walking versus running or, you know, playing soccer or playing basketball or anything else mainstream, but I love what I do, and, you know, it's that passion that keeps me going. And then because I have so much support from people in GRAF and from my family and my friends and so many others around, that, you know, it just makes it all worth it, you know. And the fact that I get to travel the world and experience so many things, you know, it's like I'm living my retirement while I'm young, in a way. I really get to just enjoy my life and, you know, revel in all the glories and all the beautiful sceneries. And, you know, I just do it really because I love it and I want to make everybody proud.
Miranda, by the way, I'm just kind of out of my own curiosity, for a race walker, are you also a runner, or is that not good for your technique in race walking?
It's better to be a full-time race walker. There are lots of people that do kind of both. We do some shakeout runs after, like, a harder speed workout just to kind of get the lactic acid out of our legs. But we mostly, most of our mileage, I would say, like, 95% is race walking.
Okay. Emily Wright, same question that Jack wanted to know. Why are you doing it?
Well, for me, it's I also love kayaking so much. There's nothing like the feeling about being out on the water and working hard and all that. But it also, I think it's also about representing my country. When I was 16, I went to my first World Championships in Norway, and I got to, they let me bear the flag for opening ceremonies there. And I just remember just thinking there is no higher honor than being here representing the United States in something that I am so lucky to be very talented at. So that's a big part of it for me.
Anya?
I have two answers. One is very personal and along the lines of Miranda and Emily. I love how it feels when I work out. I love how it feels to compete. And there's nothing like being at the top of the podium and seeing that flag being raised and hearing your national anthem. It's a great honor. The other side is, as a person having lived with a disability and working as a pediatric physical therapist, my mission also is to make the world a better place for people living with disability. And from my own experience, sport provides that. And I want to show what we're capable of. They're amazing times that are being raced in the para side. And if we didn't have such a slow boat that we had to race, we could be, some of our athletes could be compatible with able-bodied people.
Yeah, you must have really remarkable inspiration to kind of provide to people who are going through a lot, having gone through at 10 years old yourself, cancer, losing a leg. When you talk to people about their own challenges, and especially kids, they could be scared. Do you remember how long it took you to feel, for lack of a better word, normal or able to adjust after what happened to you at the age of 10?
I think so I was just, it hit me right before puberty. I remember being puberty, which I understand is awkward for everyone. It was especially awkward for me, I felt. And it wasn't until I was 15, 16. So a good 5 years, I would say, until I felt like, I don't want that leg back. I'm good the way it is, and I'm going to make the best out of it. I'm going to show you, kind of attitude.
Yeah, well, you certainly have. So, Iris, again, it's a little different for you now, but let kind of go back in time for us. You also were in these athletes' positions, having to make decisions on, what am I going to do with my time? Am I going to invest this energy? Am I going to train? Am I going to go for this? Why do it?
So I feel like I'm quote unquote in the normal world now. And when you're an athlete, it's unbelievable. I'm going overseas. My passport was so full, I had to get another pages in it. I have friends all over the world. Why do you do it? You do it because you love the sport and you're passionate about it. You do it because you are challenging yourself. You do it because you don't want to just day in, day out, sit here, do the work that someone says, go to school and that's it, and come home, play video games, because you know that you have more in you, because you know that there's more to life than just sitting on the couch. Even if it means I have to work harder than that person. And that's what I always felt, even in high school, because I go, oh, I never got invited to parties at high school. I was like a nerd, always in the library, because I always had to make up work. I was gone about 3 months of the year during school, and the kids would ask me that, why do you do it? Because we're going to this party this weekend or whatever. I do it because I just came back from Paris at 14 years old, and I'm on the podium and I'm listening to the national anthem, and there are guys who are coaches and they're crying because I'm the first American to win that medal. You do it because you love the sport, and you do it because you want more.
And now, as a 14-year-old, you love that thrill of maybe being on a podium in a foreign country. But now, as an adult, to have friends around the world, you can't put a price on that.
Exactly. I'm going to travel to Germany, and I have friends that I competed with, and now I want to go hang out and see her kids. So
awesome stuff. Yeah. Awesome. Mike, why did you do it?
Well, I think they pretty much covered it all. Really, there's two parts of it. There's the personal aspect, the love for what you do, and that's just the hard work part of it, and making it. It's easier to do the hard work if you love it. But really, it's, in the end, the Olympics is still the pinnacle, certainly of amateur sports, maybe the NBA, things like that. It might be different for some of those fully pro sports that do go to the Olympics, too. I mean, you got to remember that only changed in the 90s, where it used to be amateurs only. But I think on the amateur side, if you're a kayaker or anything, sure, there's a world championship every year. And if you're a world champ, that's great. But I got to tell you, an Olympic medal tops any resume.
Well, we're almost out of time, and you know, Graf didn't come on the program today. They didn't email Connections and say, we really need to raise money. Come, they said, we've got great stories to tell. But I, as the host, I'm allowed to ask you. You know, the community supports you. You rely on that kind of contribution. And if anybody has heard these stories this hour and wants to get involved, Mike, what can people do?
So to contact us, the easiest thing to do is go to our website. We are coming out of the dark ages. We, you know, we started off before, we've been around since social media, before it existed. And, you know, originally it was pretty much solely funded by letter writing campaigns and a few events like a golf tournament or something. Over the years, that changed. The golf tournament went away, and it's been mostly just a letter writing campaign. Bob Silver, our former president, was leading that up. And then as we came on the board, and he turned 90 this past year, he'll turn 91 this year and turn over the reins to us. And now we're trying to be a little bit more about media. And so if you wanted the short answers, if you go to our website at grafusa.org, so that's GRAAFUSA.org, there's a link right on there to click, and you can donate right there. There's also a place to email us, and if you did that, it'll come to our board. And if you want to help in any other way, our money comes from individuals primarily, and that's we're almost solely funded by that. But there's also in-kind things. There's a number of local community businesses that donate services and things like that that athletes might need. So if somebody might need personal training or help with their shoes or something like that, there's always that out there too. So if you're a business like that and want to contact us, want to get involved in somehow, then that's a great way to do it too.
All these sports are so competitive. We're down to our last 30 seconds. A great year for Graf would be what, Mike?
Oh boy, if you know, just getting people to the Olympics is our main goal. But in the end, supporting these people with great dreams and great athletes to even be trying, I think, makes Rochester proud. If we get people to the Olympics, it's even better. We get some medals. Well, that just caps it all off.
Well, and I hope you'll come back and talk to us because the Olympics coming in August, but there's, as you've heard from these athletes, are these various competitions and trials that are going to be coming in the coming months here. Good luck to everybody. Miranda on the phone with us. Thank you for taking the time to join us. Good luck to you. Congrats on all your success already, Miranda.
Thank you very much.
That's Miranda Melville. She competing in race walking. Emily Wright, Anya Pierce in the boats. Emily and Anya, thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for sharing your stories. Have fun this year. And again, so much success already. Iris, thank you for sharing your story as well as telling us the story of Graf. It's been great having you. And Mike as well. Thanks, sir. Good luck to everyone. And it's Graf, G-R-A-A-F, USA.org. Thanks to Valerie LaBanca, the engineer of this broadcast, and Megan Mack is the producer. I'm Evan Dawson, and thank you for listening to Connections on member-supported public radio.